Now, this takes very, very differing periods of time. Some people get through in as little as 10 years, the whole thing. There is a very brilliant Westerner by the name of Walter Novick, who has just about completed the whole thing. And he's a musician and a pianist. And he'll come back to this country as the first accredited Zen master of the West. And he'll set up his little sodo on a farm and wait and see what happens. The day of graduation comes. And then everybody turns out, and there's a great hullabaloo, and they salute the departing monk, and he goes out. He may just become a layman, as I said, or become a temple priest, or he may be himself a Roshi. Well, now, the essential of this whole system, as you see, is to use a hair of the dog that bit you for the cure of the bite. It's homeopathic. When people are under delusion, they cannot be talked out of the delusion. No amount of talk could persuade anybody that his ego is an illusion. Because he knows it's there. He knows I am I. And simply won't believe you if you tell him that this is nothing but post-hypnotic suggestion. So the only way to convince a fool of his folly is to make him persist in it. As Blake says, the fool who persists in his folly will become wise. By some psychiatrists I know, when they get a person who overeats and is tremendously fat, the first thing they do is they make them put on 15 more pounds. And get an alcoholic terribly drunk. Oh, and sick and just as awful as could be, you see. Really make him go at it. See, that's a method that's used. Sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. It's a rather desperate method. Rather dangerous method. Zen is dangerous too. People could easily go crazy under this sort of strain without a good advisor. Well, it is clear, of course, that this method of Zen training is most unsuited to the modern age. And this is witnessed too by the fact that the temples are relatively empty. Myo Shinji, the biggest one in Kyoto, is built to house 600 monks. There are only 80. And you might think that was quite a crowd, but it isn't, compared with the old days. To young people in Japan today, this is all incomprehensible. They see no point in it. A few, yes, but they are mostly clergy sons carrying out the family tradition. And that's very bad indeed, to be sent to a monastery virtually. As though the only possible success can come for someone who goes because he feels that nothing else in the world will satisfy him. He just has to do it. And so the traditions, as in all these ancient organizations, have become very fixed. A lot of it's meaningless. It is certainly not going to last, not in that form. It's falling apart right under our eyes. It's old and it's set in its ways. Also, since the time of Hakuin, the koans have been given fixed answers. That is to say, there is a sort of prescribed way in which to answer, and you've got to hit on the right one. And then after you've answered it, you have to find a poem from a little book called the Zen Rinkushu, which means the Zen Forest Anthology. And there are little couplets, and you've got to find one which represents the meaning of your koan. I mean, you know, take the four divisions of Tokyo out of your sleeve. Nothing could be simpler. But some monk has recently threatened to publish all the answers to the koans so that the masters would have to get on their toes and invent new ones. I know a Roshi who invents new ones. And the moment they open their mouths, he stops them. No. Too late. You know, he says, you could ask a Christian, what's the first word in the Bible? And things like that. It becomes much more lively, you see, when there is this quick interchange of the teacher and the students. But in modern idiom, who the devil wants to know about Joshu's moo anymore, or some ancient fellow's questions, couched in language, incidentally. This is part of the problems they have. The language of these koans is very archaic. I mean, what is the sound of one hand? Well, there's a Chinese proverb which says, one hand won't make a clap. So if you don't know that proverb, if that proverb is in everyday use, and I say to you, what is the sound of one hand? Then it has some sense. But there are all kinds of, shall I say, references, allusions in the old stories. And they therefore don't necessarily fit our world or the Japanese world of today. You have to take the koans out of everyday life, things that are going on now, you see. I mean, it's like asking, what's that man who advertises Schweppes, Commander Whitehead? Why has Commander Whitehead no beard? There was, though, you see, there was a division in the history of Zen. There was a critical point in the 17th century when there were two very great masters, Hakuin and Bankei. Now, the 17th century is tremendously important in Japanese history because that was a time when, of what you might call the democratization of culture. Basho invented haiku poetry so that everyone could be a poet. Not necessarily for publication, but for one's own fun. People didn't write poems for publication necessarily. They wrote poems for parties. And he invented the 17-syllable haiku as a result of his Zen feeling for nature, so that he could put this within the reach of everybody. What had happened to poetry before that time was that it had become so obscure and so effete and so sophisticated that only great literati could do it at all. This happened to Chinese poetry. There were so many references to other poems, it was like reading T.S. Eliot. You know, in the four quartets. You could get an annotated four quartets showing you the sources of all the phrases he's borrowed. And sometimes you have to know the source in order to see what he means by it. And all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. All right, that's straight from the Revelations of the Divine Love by Dame Julian of Norwich. But whoever would know that? And you have to understand the scene she was digging in order to know really what Eliot's getting at in that all shall be well. And he's full of that. He quotes the Bhagavad Gita. He quotes everybody. So if we all had to write that way, nobody could be a poet, unless he was a great scholar. So Basho popularized the haiku. And the haiku are originally based on the Zenrin poems. They take their flavor from that. There is one, you see, that bird calls, mountain changes to be more mysterious. The first line of that says, the wind drops, but the flowers keep on falling. The bird calls and the mountain becomes more mysterious. And so haiku developed from that kind of short insight, that glimpse of nature. Now, while Basho was taking poetry to the peasants, Bankei was taking Zen to them as well, to the farmers. And he ran his Zen on an entirely different system. He talked mainly about what he called Hushō. Hushō is the unborn, that which has not yet arisen and which, as a matter of fact, never does arise. And so he said, there is in you the unborn mind which was given to you by your parents. Let me just read you a few quotations from him to show you what sort of a person he was. The mind begotten by and given to each of us by our parents is none other than the Buddha mind, birthless and immaculate, sufficient to manage all that life throws upon us. A proof. Suppose at this very instant, while you face me listening, a crow caws and a sparrow twitters somewhere behind you. Without any intention on your part to distinguish between these sounds, you hear each distinctly. In doing so, you are hearing with the birthless mind, which is yours for all eternity. Well, we are to be in this mind from now on, and our sect will be known as the Buddha Mind Sect. To consider my example of a moment ago once again, if any of you feel you heard the crow and the sparrow intentionally, you are deluding yourselves. For you are listening to me, not to what goes on behind you. In spite of this, there are moments when you hear such sounds distinctly, when you hear with the Buddha mind of non-birth. Nobody here can deny this. All of you are living Buddhas because the birthless mind which each possesses is the beginning and the basis of all. Now, if the Buddha mind is birthless, it is necessarily immortal, for how can what has never been born perish? You've all encountered the phrase birthless and imperishable in the sutras, not born, not dying, you know. But hitherto you've not had the slightest proof of its truth. Indeed, I suppose, like most people, you've memorized this phrase while being ignorant of the fact of birthlessness. When I was 25, I realized that non-birth is all sufficient to life, and since then, for 40 years, I've been proving it to people just like you. I was the first to preach this greatest truth of life. I ask, have any of you priests heard anybody else teach this truth before me? Of course not. A priest said to him, once in the Buddha mind, I'm absent-minded. Bankei says, well, suppose you're absent-minded as you say. If someone pricked you in the back with a gimlet, would you feel the pain? Naturally. Then you are not absent-minded. Feeling the pain, your mind would show itself to be alert. A layman says, though I undertake Zen discipline, I often find myself lazy, weary of the whole thing, unable to advance. And he replies, once in the Buddha mind, there's no need to advance, nor is it possible to recede. Once in birthlessness, to attempt to advance is to have receded from the state of non-birth. A man secure in that state need not bother himself with such things. He's above them. The Buddha mind in each of you is immaculate. All you've done is reflected in it. But if you bother about one such reflection, you're certain to go astray. Your thoughts don't lie deep enough. They rise from the shallows of your mind. Remember that all you see and hear is reflected in the Buddha mind and influenced by what was previously seen and heard. Needless to say, thoughts aren't entities. So if you permit them to rise, reflect themselves, or cease altogether as they are prone to do, and if you don't worry about them, you'll never go astray. In this way, let 100, nay 1,000 thoughts arise, and it's as if not one has arisen. You will remain undisturbed. The only thing I tell my people is to stay in the Buddha mind. There are no regulations, no formal discipline. Nevertheless, they have agreed among themselves to sit in Zen for a period of 2 incense sticks daily. All right, let them. But they should well understand that the birthless Buddha mind has absolutely nothing to do with sitting with an incense stick burning in front of you. If one keeps in the Buddha mind without straying, there's no further Satori to seek. Whether awake or asleep, one is a living Buddha. Zazen means only one thing, sitting tranquilly in the Buddha mind. But really, you know, one's everyday life in its entirety should be thought of as a kind of sitting in Zen. even during one's formal sitting. One may leave one's seat to attend to something. In my temple, at least, such things are allowed. Indeed, it's sometimes advisable to walk in Zen for one incense stick's burning and sit in Zen for the other. A natural thing, after all. One can't sleep all day, so one rises. One can't talk all day, so one sits in Zen. There are no binding rules here. And so that's what happened, you see. Bankei was the abbot of Myoshinji, the Roshi. And he stopped the monks using the kaiseki stick to hit them when they weren't meditating or sleeping in meditation, because he said, even a sleeping man is still a Buddha, and you shouldn't be disrespectful. And he attempted a Zen of no methods. You can meditate if you want to, that's fine. But that's like polishing a brick to make a mirror. And he used to say, too, that trying to purify your mind is like trying to wash off blood with blood. But Bankei Zen was elusive. Hakuin had 80 successors. Bankei had none. And some people think that that was the most admirable thing about him.
This concludes Session 8 of Out of Your Mind, Essential Listening, from the Alan Watts Audio Archives. Our program continues with Session 9. True presents Out of Your Mind, Essential Listening, from the Alan Watts Audio Archives. Session 9, The World as Self, with Alan Watts.
The basis of all Indian philosophy, particularly the teaching of those books called the Upanishads, which are really the distilled essence of Hindu thought. The basis is called the self. And this word in Sanskrit is Atman, and that means self in the vastest possible sense. And the most inclusive sense of the word. It means yourself, and it means also self as such, existence as such, the totality of all being. And of course, this is something that one cannot talk about in the sense of talking about it logically. You can talk about it. A poet can talk about anything, and the Upanishads are very largely poetry. Of course, everything in the world, knives and forks, tables and chairs, trees and stones, are indescribable. Korzybski referred to the physical world as the unspeakable world, which was really rather a funny name, because it has two edges. It's, of course, something you can't say anything about, that is to say, it is ineffable. But it's unspeakable also in the sense of the word meaning something taboo. And we shall see as we go on wherein that taboo consists. But from the standpoint of logic, we can't say anything about everything. Because in order to say something about something and state it logically, you have to be able to put it in a class. Now, classes are intellectual boxes. Is it in, when you play games like animal, vegetable, and mineral, you've got there three boxes. And when you come to think of it, you don't know any one without another. Because in order to have a box, there must be what's inside the box and what's outside the box. And then by this method of contrast, we can make a logical discussion about things. All words, therefore, are labels on intellectual